You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
The Johnny Rocket Launchpad is liberty. Each week, we strive to bring you the best guests in talk radio. The Johnny Rocket Launchpad delivers weekly interviews of noteworthy politicians, experts, and activists. The Johnny Rocket Launchpad is bringing the party to the Libertarian Party and launching ideas in your direction. Check us out at johnnyrocketlaunchpad.com. You can hear me, Kurt Nelson, and the beautiful Heather Nixon talk about the ideas of liberty. Rock and roll.
Hey there, Liberty lovers. This is Mark Clare of the Lions of Liberty podcast, where we strive to bring you great conversations about the ideas of liberty 3 days a week, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Check us out at lionsofliberty.com.
Hey guys, this is Roger Paxton, and if you're fed up with the government running every single aspect of your life, but you're not listening to the Lava Flow podcast yet, then what's wrong with you? Check us out at thelavaflow.com, or just go back to sucking up to the government. The Lava Flow podcast, striking the root every single episode.
We are supported by listeners like you. Donate per month or make a one-time donation through PayPal or Patreon at wearelibertarians.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We Are Libertarians brings you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. We explain to you what the hell is happening in our world today and how we can fix it by thinking differently. This is a podcast brought to you by the We Are Libertarians Network. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. That's how we grow up the charts. Like us on Facebook, share this episode with friends, because that's how we grow in subscribers, and support us through PayPal or Patreon at wearelibertarians.com, which is how we grow in services to you. We are supported by listeners like you, so that $1 per episode by pledging $5 a month helps us grow. We are always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@wearelibertarians.com. With me, finally, again, after bailing last week, is Greg Lenz.
You know, you miss 1 week when Lion Rob Kendall's on, and all of a sudden you're the bad guy.
Well, this is the second time that you've skipped on Lion Rob.
Well, that's a good point, but it's Lion Rob Kendall.
And he lied a lot.
Well, yeah. He still thinks the wall's real.
I know. That other laugh that you hear is Matt Whitliff. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Matt is running for Congress in Indiana in the 5th District. You are challenging Susan Brooks.
Yes, she is the incumbent.
Yes, she's a Republican. And is there a Democrat in the race?
There is a Democrat in the race. Her name is Angela Damari.
Yeah, well, don't plug her. What are you doing?
Well, that's fair.
Is she a placeholder candidate?
Basically.
That's, yeah.
Now, most importantly, you listen
to the 5th District.
Yeah, it's all Republicans. It's just a bunch of scumbag Republicans.
that hopefully will vote for Matt.
Right. Yes. So Matt, you claim to listen to the program, right?
Yes, I do claim that.
How often?
So I think I started getting into the whole rhythm of listening to podcasts earlier this year. And so I've probably listened to everything you've done this year.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
We're sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, so you've heard Rob get canceled on by Greg Lenz twice this year.
Yep, that's right.
So Rob was very hurt.
Was he hurt?
He was very hurt.
Well, we'll make it up to him, because I think we're going to record with him, what, on Tuesday?
But, no. Well, yeah, I think we're going to do his show as a debate recap. Mm-hmm. I better write that down. Now,
you're welcome.
Yeah, remind me later. It was okay, because he had his love and comfort here, Aaron Ewert. And also his girlfriend Haley was here, so.
I actually watched, so like my voice was killing me, and I'd been battling with some chest congestion, and so I was watching.
Pneumonia?
Yeah, I had the, I actually vomited a frog like Hillary, and then I read Revelations.
What is wrong with Greg Lenz? Start the memes.
My eyes are wandering. I just couldn't believe how animated you got. Like, you and Rob, he does play the foil, and he plays it well, but
yeah.
I felt like there was a little bit of truth behind your triggering.
Well, Rob's an idiot, and he's a liar. That's why I call him Flopping Rob, because he's not consistent. No, it's so funny. Like, I got, like, several messages from people like, are you and Rob okay? That was very intense. And I didn't think I got any more heated than I normally do calling someone an idiot. They just were in the room this time. And he was lying. He wasn't telling the truth.
On what specifically?
He was claiming one thing about Gary Johnson, and the opposite is true. He was saying that he has zero border policies, and his only border policy is that, just open the border, let them all in.
Honestly, that's the toughest part about being a libertarian, is like, there is such a lot of misinformation about what you believe due to the label. Yeah. And so it's like, oh, you're the libertarian candidate. So you want nothing.
You want absolutely nothing.
And to solve the Social Security crisis, you want to just put all the old people on ice floes and send them out to sea.
Right.
You know, it's like, not exactly. Because did you watch the 60 Minutes with Gary and Bill?
I did. Yes.
Like, Gary fought that. Like, they specifically asked him a question, you know, about, are your ideas mainstream? And his point was, we are the nominees of the Libertarian Party. That doesn't mean we hold every view of our party's platform.
Right, yeah, sure. No, and that's in the case with Rob. I mean, arguing, and here's the challenge that we talk about all the time for libertarian candidates, and this is one of the challenges with Gary. We have a libertarian candidate here that, you know, the immigration policy, as I'm reading off of his website what Gary Johnson believes, I'm going, there is a large segment of our audience who's just going to go, well, that's it. He's not libertarian. He's a statist.
Yep.
But at the same time, if you're running for political office in 2016, you're running to reform the government in a certain direction. You're not running for
who's the most libertarian person.
You know what I mean?
How have you handled that as a candidate?
I have become even more moderate and centrist in my libertarianism in this campaign than I was coming into it. And I came into it as a pragmatist, right? But yeah, my goodness.
Because it's hard to put, you know, it's hard to run for office. And once you start outlining your policies, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially to run seriously, right? So the libertarians have, you know, a history of running paper candidates. And
martyrs.
Or semi-paper martyrs, if you will.
I mean, they are to me, because they literally don't want to win. They look at it as an educational platform.
Yeah. So a paper candidate, just to define that, is somebody who literally just puts their name on the ballot.
Crooked Hillary.
So there is a libertarian in the race. There's also scaled up. I mean, in 2012, when I was the executive director, I said, listen, that doesn't cut it anymore. If you're going to be a candidate for us, the new definition of paper candidate is you're getting a headshot, you're writing a bio, you're putting a website together, you're going to answer surveys. And that was active in the 80s and 90s.
That was active.
You know, and now, you know, there's campaigns around the country and in Indiana that are running full-scale, full-time campaigns. When we did it with Rupert in 2012, that was a novelty. Nobody was doing that. So
you're saying it was placeholders mainly and like paper candidates up until the 90s?
The theory is that if the greatest place to promote the party is in the ballot box, and in the pre-internet age, the Libertarian Party, truthfully, the best way for people to know there was a Libertarian Party was for them to see it on their ballot, because that was a free way to promote the party. And then there were multitudes of people, generations of libertarians, who first heard about the party that way and contacted the local party. Now we're in the internet age, and it's easy to get to people. It's different now. And it's also, you know, in 2010, we ran like 100 candidates and had a lot of these paper candidates. And they, Nuvo is our alternative weekly here in Indianapolis.
Yep.
And always somewhat friendly. It's more progressive views than libertarian views. But they're always generally friendly to us. And they were one of the first media outlets to include us in things. And none of our candidates running for state house and state senate had headshots. And so they just ran it because the Libertarian Party of Marion County cannot provide headshots, we will now be replacing all the photos of all of their candidates with JCPenney models. And it was just...
not a bad idea.
Yeah, actually,
I mean,
might have worked out for us.
I was going to say, like, if I have to be replaced, I'm going to take a professional model.
You've seen libertarians.
Right? Yeah. I don't need somebody that's not making eye contact and got freckles or pimples all over their face.
I resemble that remark. So, yeah, that's when I really said, 2012, we're doing this differently. And we did, but, you know, your question to Matt was, if you're running a serious campaign and you're out there talking to voters who are independent, who are, let's just be frank, there's very few people in the United States who aren't statists, according to a pure libertarian. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think that there are a lot of people. I think a lot of libertarians. I mean, the whole charm of this program is that we just admit that we don't know everything and we're trying to figure it all out.
Yeah.
And move more and more libertarian, and you hear us struggle with those questions and try to apply the philosophy to modern current events. And that pure libertarian philosophy, I think, in some ways it is what everybody believes, but at the same time, it's not what everybody believes in terms of application.
Right, right. No, I mean, absolutely. And there's different strategies to it. And so some strategy out there is, you know, let's be as pure to the message as possible and, you know, vote totals, you know, who cares what that is, but at least, you know, if I can convert 1 out of 10 people I talk to hear that message and resonate, now I've created one more libertarian, and you build from there. But that's a slow process, right? And so, you know, what I see, especially this cycle, is there's so much opportunity. People are so tired, so fed up with the status quo and the establishment, and they're hungry for new voices and new ideas. So, you know, I went into this campaign thinking, all right, you know, you had the rise of Trumpism on the right, which, despite whatever policy positions are going on there, there's a definite populist anti-establishment undercurrent going there, right? Bernie coming out of nowhere on the left, right? And that shows that, you know, there's a lot of people fed up. So I wanted to try to tap into as much of that as possible, but still through a libertarian message. So, you know, I'm focusing a lot of my outreach on the progressive side, the disaffected, you know, Bernie supporters and things like that. And there's common ground to be had, and more than I think I maybe even realized coming into the campaign, which has been frankly awesome, right? And so I'm becoming more and more. I was always a big tent libertarian, but like, maybe we need to move from a tent to a house or something.
Now, why did you decide on going after the left? Because when you're running a campaign as a libertarian, you could go either direction.
Yeah.
You could go the Ron Paul route, or you could go the Gary Johnson route.
Sure. I think it's twofold. You know, one is just the dynamics of the 5th District, you know, play into that. So the 5th District is incredibly red, if you will. It's a very strong Republican stronghold. And so it's hard to get people to switch off from Team Red. And we've learned that through other campaigns. Chris, you and I have worked on campaigns together, right?
Yeah. The Rupert's campaign, for instance, in 2012, we were accused of stealing votes from John Gregg, the Democrat. I mean, it's because he talked about...
Well, that's kind of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is a lot like the Democratic governor's nominee in Indiana because he's pro-fair trade, you know, everyone getting the same playing field. And then he's also claims to be pro-business. Mm-hmm. And then he's socially conservative.
Yeah.
And pro police union. I mean, there are just a lot of crossover. I mean, but in Indiana, you're not going to get a liberal unless you're in Marion County or Lake County, probably.
Yeah.
You know,
you'll get a little bit in Bloomington, but
Bloomington. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm surprised to hear this. You say the 5th is, to me, the 5th would be Donald Trump's district.
Mm-hmm.
You got some country club Republicans for sure.
You do.
Especially in Hamilton County and aspects of Boone, which it's only really Zionsville, so that is going to be country club Republicans for the most part.
And like old farmers.
And then the northern Indianapolis, right? So there's a little bit of, you know, kind of the Meridian Kessler money concentration there. But
Cocktail and dinner party Republicans.
Exactly. But once you get out of those, you know,
like Madison County places, to me would be like, that is a Trump district if there ever were a Trump district.
Absolutely. Or Tipton.
Tipton's perfect. I mean, it's like a socially conservative centrist area, but the Democratic Party's had such a hard time really getting any traction at all in Indiana that they end up being Republican, but that Trump firebrand populism kind of plays to those people.
Well, what you have to understand about the northern corridor of Indiana, northeast, but especially straight up 31, which is called Meridian Street in Indianapolis, because it's the center, dead center of not only the city of Indianapolis, but the state of Indiana. And it goes all the way up to South Bend, which is in the middle of Indiana, and the north end. That whole north central corridor in the 2000s lost 700,000 jobs in a state of 6.6 million people. And so we're talking about, because Indianapolis was second only to Detroit in the auto industry from 100 years on. Right. That's how the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500 was founded. It was a car test track in 1909. And it became a car race as a way for people to test cars. Duesenberg was here. Mm-hmm. So
Studebaker,
Chevrolet,
Oldsmobile. Yeah. You know, you had Delphi, Delco, all these companies. So, you know, car manufacturers didn't make the plastic dashboard that goes in your car. They would hire somebody like one of these Delco or Delphi type companies, you know, and it normally would be somewhere between Detroit and Indianapolis, mm-hmm. up in this northeastern corridor. And when the auto industry collapsed in the late 2000s, we shed, you know, 750,000 jobs is a lot. And yeah. So as the
10%, over 10% of the working population, or the population of the state.
Yeah. Yeah. And as the executive director of the Libertarian Party, who was traveling it from 2008 to 2012, and starting parties there, it was a hotbed for us because it's because of that, disenfranchisement. And so if
maybe NAFTA wasn't such a good idea. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't vote for that.
Yeah.
Candidate.
So, and that's
at the time, Bill Clinton.
So it's a very weird political group because, you know, as largely union members, as people who would vote Democrat, but they're also gun-loving Democrats.
Blue Dog Democrats.
You've got, you know, maybe what would be considered Reagan Democrats.
You've got
a Reagan Democrat is somebody who owns a small business of, you know, like a plumbing company who believes...
Trade.
But they're also very conservative people, and so the Republicans weren't diehard Republicans. The Democrats weren't diehard progressives. And the Tea Party was extremely popular during that period in this part of the state, because anti-NAFTA, pro protectionism. And so, yeah, I would think that it's a hotbed of Trumpism because of that protectionism.
How do you cater your message to that?
Yeah. Focusing there on Constitution.
Okay.
Right? Focusing there on government spending. Right. Those are the messages, especially on you know, that side of the right, government overreach, dropping regulations, moving things back to the state and local. You know, those are the issues on the right in terms of my target audience for the libertarian message that we're going after. Right?
Constitutional republicanism.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Govern local, govern local.
Yeah. Yeah, the place where it's broken down that I've seen this cycle is on immigration.
That's the most interesting part of this entire... But that's the funny part, is that's tied to the trade.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think
they're inseparable.
Right. I mean, a lot of these people... it's a very agrarian... You take somewhere like... what's Kokomo in Howard County?
That's Howard County, yeah.
So you take a Kokomo or a Tipton County where you have a lot of this auto industry that has failed... and then it's
manufacturing. It's gone.
The other part of it is an agrarian society. What you have these union workers who are also and union and farmhands have always been very close, you know, in terms of organizing labor. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of Cesar Chavez. I mean, he was really a farmhand union organizer. You have a lot of these folks mixing with modern farmhands, shall we say. And so when you...
I don't know what you mean. Please clarify.
When you... Mexicans. So when you're out of work and they're working and you're not...
Doesn't feel good.
It doesn't feel good. And a lot of tension.
I would think that's... Like, to me, that's the hardest thing. Like, for me, it's actually not... a problem to be fair trade before I'm free trade. Like, mm-hmm. I don't have a problem doing that as a libertarian because I want everybody to start from the same platform regardless. Yeah. But obviously that's a theoretical endpoint, not where we are.
Correct.
You know, but I feel like that is in this election, that is a hams, like, that is a detriment to every libertarian candidate. Where do you come down on trade? Well, let me tell you about borders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because it's, you know, it's an intricate thing to explain to people that want answers now.
Yep.
And they want an enemy.
Yeah.
They want
Nuance
someone
is
to blame.
Tough.
It is.
Yeah. And it's even tougher on social media. Shocker.
Oh, yeah. How effective have you been able to successfully get out of the silo of libertarians?
Yes. Yes. I'm getting a decent amount of response coming from that Bernie progressive side. Right?
That's amazing.
And some of them still think I'm, a clearly hate-filled, greedy capitalist because I say something like, the words free market come out of my mouth, right?
Mm-hmm. But how disgusting.
But there's a good number who can listen past that and are beginning to respond. Got a great message from, a now supporter that's posted on my Facebook page just saying, hey, I was a Bernie supporter. Matt came in and sent this message on Facebook, and I thought he was probably just trying to pick at the bones like a vulture. Yeah. But the more I listened to him, this is him talking. The more I listened to him, the more I realized we have a lot in common, right? And so a lot of what I've couched that message around is, look, progressives, we may not share the same approach on solutions, but we share a lot of the same common interests in terms of what the problems that are facing this country, especially the problems that the establishment is either not willing to talk about or continues to perpetuate day after day after day. Right. And that's catching people.
I was going to say, that's something I didn't necessarily have the hatred for Bernie. A lot of libertarians did early on because he didn't rise by promising free college. He rose because he promised an end to corruption and cronyism and those things.
He an end to the Hillary Clinton establishment. That's exactly what we all want.
Right. And the problem is, though, is unlike the hard thing to get through to progressives is that there aren't these mythical like-minded, pure-hearted government bureaucrats that are going to take over this institution that if you make bigger are going to end corruption. What happens is you hand it over when you lose to someone like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And that's why the dilemma of liberalism and progressivism is the monster you create you won't always be in charge of in a democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the corollary to that message, or maybe it precedes it, but is when you are outraged at whether it's injustice or whatever is going on, and you seek to find solutions and you seek to the government to find the solution, they are the biggest perpetuator in the history of mankind of injustice.
Yeah.
Right. You cannot put your faith in it. Right. And so it's one more logical leap that's tough. And
again,
it's nuanced, right? So it is difficult to get across in political sound bites, but I'm trying.
Yeah. And as long as it works.
Bureaucracy, as you've heard on various programs, episodes 165, 166, or no, it was 160, 161, 144, all the way back to episode, I think it was 14, where we talk about the closing of the smoke shops locally. Government bureaucracy not only kills businesses, it also kills people. And that's kind of what we can get around. And we'll talk about that in just a moment, but I want to take a break here and mention a new service from We Are Libertarians. Greg Lenz does a great job of nearly daily putting together a ton for libertarians to read. You put together a ton of links that's news that just doesn't get picked up on the front page of The Hill or Politico or CBS News.
It's not sexy news.
No, but I think it's important news.
Yeah, I think it's, the goal's always been for me is that how can we fill in the gaps for libertarians so we're seen as serious in discussions? And the height of that came to fruition this year, even though it shouldn't have been, and it ended up working out well with Aleppo, is that we have to know just as much and we have to hold ourselves to the exact same standards as the best and brightest of the two major parties because we don't get a break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Clearly we learned we don't get the benefit of the doubt where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton do. Yeah. So we have to hold ourselves to an even higher standard, and that's what you've taken and turned into the Dispatch.
Yeah.
Is it's a collection of links that I try to fill in with policy gaps, current news, and then as well, I try to challenge you with things you maybe might disagree with. I tend to take from the Federalist. I don't know if everyone's familiar with that website, mm-hmm. and they're a little more socially conservative.
A little.
I mean, they are, but then they're also really good on economics. But, I think it's good that we defend our positions against the opposite viewpoint so we get good at it.
Yeah.
And that's been the problem is a lot of times when we're challenged directly, we try to change I guess the premise. We don't, instead of taking it head on and taking dissecting it, we turn it into, well, the government's corruption anyway, yada yada yada, rather than single-handedly taking it apart, which when you refine it and go against this consistently, it allows you to.
Yeah. So what I have done is I've taken upon myself to, you know, he posted on the website and we actually get really decent traffic on it, you know, and we get decent traffic on WeareLibertarians.com. I mean, we're up to like 300 a day.
Are we really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And growing.
But no memes.
No. There's zero memes. It's just walls of text on We're Libertarians.
Very libertarian.
Yeah, but we've got a lot of resources, and I've done a lot of SEO work, too.
Yeah.
So people can find us, but I've taken the Dispatch. I've created an email newsletter that's going out mostly daily. Like, I didn't get time yesterday or today to send it out, but there will be one tomorrow, probably almost definitely Saturday, Sunday. And I'm going to send it out about 6 a.m. So it's right in your inbox, first thing in the morning. It starts off with Spangle's Angle. I've revived it from my high school.
I love it.
My high school column days. So notes from the desk of Dear Leader. And I put in there a little thought. And generally, one thing a day really just annoys the shit out of me. And I write about it and I put that in there, you know, 100 to 300 words or whatever.
How have you liked writing daily?
I like it.
Do you? Yeah. I know you've always liked writing, but you haven't had the time.
I really made a concerted effort. I've wanted to write daily and produce more for We Are Libertarians and give more stuff out to our listeners for free. Time runs out, and I just decided, you know what, I'm not going to make excuses, I'm just going to do it. And if I do this thing that we put out daily, it's going to force me to do this thing that I really want to do and become better at, which is writing. So I already write on my Facebook page every day. It's something that pisses me off. So a lot of it is adapted like that for this audience.
Usually it's libertarians.
Yeah. Usually I just hate my own people. Yeah.
Let me tell you something about you people that you don't know.
I go to church. I hate the Christians. I go to libertarian meetings. I hate the libertarians.
Popular guy.
Just an iconoclast to the last. And then we've got Greg's links. I add some links. Things from WeAreLibertarians.com. A video of the day. There was a really great one in episode in the fourth Dispatch. It's like a cartoon. It's called Freedom Tunes. And you can find it on our Facebook page. And it's basically about libertarian stereotypes. I'm going to start posting a meme. I'm bringing memes to your inbox.
I love it.
So
I need to. I got to get the archive of Spangle memes uploaded. Yes. I went through last night and did some. I guess I built a collage of sorts, and it was over 560. So just we're good for almost a year,
just
or
of
2 years. Huh? Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
All right. So get that in your inbox. It's right on the. Go to WeAreLibertarians.com. It's on the sidebar there. You can sign up. You can sign up on our Facebook page, get the We Are Libertarians Dispatch, and we will send you the news. It's basically an offshoot of the... We actually do take this seriously.
I signed up via the news feed.
Did you?
It showed up in my news feed. Excellent. With a little button, sign up now. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm trying to do this with my campaign and no one's clicking on the dang button. So I'm going to click on this button.
No one's clicking on the button?
No, some people are clicking on the button.
Good. We
should order them to click on the button.
We have like 60 people. I can't believe it. Already.
But wow. I did sign up for weekly, and I think you're sending it to me daily, but
it's
I won't
too late.
Complain much.
I got rid of that feature. You're getting it daily.
It's the old bait and switch.
Yep. So.
Oh, no, it'll only be once a week. Feature eliminated.
There are some people who are getting the newsletter by force.
Yes.
You were getting me in your inbox whether you asked for it or not.
You should just go through our likes and just sign up every person that's liked the page.
I signed up Mark Warner and Michael Neal.
That's outstanding. Great Republicans they are.
Mark Warner is the political director for the Indiana GOP, and Michael Neal is the head of the Young Republicans for the state of Indiana. And I added their email addresses.
Well, I want them to be free too. Right. You know?
Oh, that's solid trolling. Every day they wake up and there's my face in their inbox. Never forget.
Even Republican Lives Matter.
Yes.
They are two of like the greatest guys in the Indiana GOP. Are. Like hands down, two of my favorite.
So yeah, get that in your inbox. We would greatly appreciate it. Forward it to a friend. And listen, we take it seriously. We read a lot of stuff. And this is the offshoot. This is the This is the output of what doesn't make the show we're putting into this email newsletter. So check it out. And I've hired Tyler to write some racist stuff for me, and then I'm going to blame him 30 years from now.
For those listening, that's a Ron Paul reference.
Ron Paul joke.
So let's get into the news. We have several situations happening across the nation. Yeah, and it kind of ties into the Snowden movie. I think with the situation in Charlotte, the situation in Chelsea, New York, and the Snowden movie, we're going to kind of tie all those together a little bit. And I want to start with this premise, because I think it's something that I've been thinking about. I read an article. I actually saw crime statistics. I forget where I saw it at. I was in one of the Dispatch links. And crime of every sort is massively down. Like, it is insane how few murders and rapes and how safe we are. And then the next day, the Cato Institute put out a response, so to speak, of the Skittles analogy that Donald Trump Jr. said, which is, if you had a bowl of Skittles and three could kill you, then would you eat the Skittles? Well, the truth is that no Syrian refugee, nor really any refugee, has ever committed an act of terrorism on American soil in the modern age. It's all been people who are living here, you know, like the
Sarnet brothers.
Yeah, I almost said the Dolezal brothers. That's the lady in Idaho who
Rachel Dolezal.
Yeah,
she went the NAACP white lady.
She went racial trans. Yeah. Sorry, Matt. Your campaign ends today.
Yeah. Well, he's been very popular with the racial trans vote.
So we have we have an analogy that just doesn't make sense. You know, and Cato put out the study that it's like 1 in 10 million is your chance of getting killed by a Syrian refugee. You basically are 1 in 4,000 likely to get murdered by an American and 1 in 3 million to get murdered by a terrorist.
And if you're a black teen, about 1 in 21 by a cop.
Right. So the Cato Institute study was really interesting, and it just showed you the panic that people like Little Rob Kendall, where there's a brown person hiding around every corner waiting to rape your precious white daughter, that doesn't actually exist. So Rob's just wrong and a little racist. So we have, but at the same time, there's a growing sense of insecurity. You have the bombings in Chelsea, New York City. You have the guy stabbing seven people in Minnesota. Did they die? Was it seven people that died or just seven people?
I know
people that
seven
got
people stabbed. And I really should have followed up. But yeah. I mean, stabbing's bad enough. Nobody wants to go around and get stabbed.
So we'll look that up here in just a moment. And then we also have the Charlotte riots, where you have a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You have a police officer in Charlotte, North Carolina, killing another set of black people, and it now seems that we're having this conversation every couple of months.
We are. I mean, there is a, you know, yes, we're safer. You, I, and Matt, we, yeah, us three are very much safer.
Oh yeah.
African-American teens are not safer,
right,
at all. I mean, they, you know, or I guess Harry would lecture me, black teens.
Yes.
But you know, that is the growing problem in America, and it's widespread. I mean, Ferguson was the first introduction on a massive scale in the American, I guess, zeitgeist.
In this, this current round,
yeah,
for sure.
And
yeah,
now we're at the point where it was one. And then Tamir Rice felt to me like a bubble moment when it's a 12-year-old kid with a plastic toy gun and he gets killed in Cleveland in a park.
Yeah.
Now we're at the point where Charlotte looked like, I don't want to say like anywhere in the Middle East, but it looked incredibly bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you guys get to watch any of the CNN coverage?
I did watch some of the CNN coverage last night, and it was a wall of police trying to push back.
Firing tear gas, right, over and over.
Yeah. And then coming back and then forward. Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to see it, but I heard some descriptions on the radio.
It was one ineffective, because what ended up happening is the protesters would disperse and go wreck the storefronts to where they would disperse to get away from the tear gas. Then when the tear gas stopped, they'd come right back.
Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm just watching it. And listen, I'm not a police officer. I don't know riot control, but allow me to have an opinion nonetheless.
I am a millennial.
I am a millennial with a podcast. I'm watching it last night going, you know what? What if the police just like turned around and walked away? Wouldn't that just deflate the protest boner? You know, and I'm not going to say protesters, because they made it very clear on the news that the people who were legitimately protesting left at dusk, mm-hmm. and then the rioters came out. And there is a very big difference between the Black Lives Matter protesters and the rioters.
Yeah.
The people who are out there to have fun by breaking other people's stuff. So I want to make that distinction clear. So if we accidentally say protesters when we mean rioters, please forgive that slip of the tongue. Because there is a big difference between somebody who peacefully riots or peacefully riots and peacefully
protest
and angrily protest. So it just look at it and go, it's like, man, they're just agitating each other. Just stand down.
Well, I heard the description of the SWAT crew, the riot crew showing up and with their billy clubs banging them against the shields to make the noise, and it's like, whole, I mean, what is this, like a military death march or something? I mean, that's it's scary.
Like, I was watching it and was just like, this is incredible in Charlotte, because where the riot took place was right by where the Carolina Panthers play, and they're actually looking at new venues for when they play, I think, the Eagles this weekend. And so Charlotte isn't like Baltimore.
No.
Charlotte isn't like Ferguson, Missouri. Charlotte is like going to Indianapolis or Fort Wayne,
Columbus, Ohio.
These very suburban
Nashville,
cities.
Nashville, Tennessee.
Right. It's the kind of place where no one lives downtown and everybody drives into town and then, you know, they're open until 9 o'clock. It's not like there isn't mass urban poverty.
Sure.
However, there is sort of a two-part system to race in Charlotte. You know, Charlotte has still to this day the highest levels of segregation in education for African American teens. And there is a really strong racial undertone between, you know, the white folk and the black folk, because they feel like they've been marginalized and mm-hmm. sort of they're the eyesore of the community in this new, nice research science triangle.
Yeah.
And there is last night was America's first introduction to a group of people in a suburban type setting, not a inner city urban setting, that are pissed off and angry, and they're not going to take it anymore, and they don't care, because they tried to push a CNN reporter into a fire. They tried to...
I watched them walk up, and the guy just tried to steal the CNN guy's camera while they were live on air.
I mean, it was as bad as it can be, and this isn't necessarily a class warfare. I mean, you can call it that if you want to, given the income inequality, but it's more so... it is a racial uprising, and we're talking about levels of people, like... Since Barack Obama's been elected, we're now at a place, according to Pew, where it's 70% think the race war is as bad as it's been since Rodney King, which is incredible, because he was supposed to be the post-racial president, you know, and he went and addressed the black caucus this last week, and that went terribly. And who was it that said they felt talked down to?
It was the first black elected governor in the United States. He was from Virginia. And it was in The Hill, I think, today, or Politico magazine. I'm pretty sure it was The Hill, where he was... no, it was Washington Post. I'm sorry. He was talking to the Washington Post in an hour interview about race relations and the Obama presidency, and he was one of the first people to support him. And he basically was saying he's been a disappointment, and specifically in racial relations. He's 81. He's seen, the civil rights.
It all come and go.
He's the first black governor elected to a state in the United States.
Income inequality is at its worst between African Americans and white Americans. I mean, it isn't a pretty picture, and there is no silver bullet. You know, Camden, New Jersey is a city that's had as bad of racial problems as there is.
Oh, yeah.
That, to the point they disbanded their police force.
Right. Yeah, there's a... Screw it. We're going home.
Right. They did. They had to. And so they ended up creating a community civilian police force, and it has done wonders on rebuilding trust.
Now, where is this?
Camden, New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah.
It's done an incredible job at rebuilding trust and getting buy-in from all citizens of the community to create that sense of ownership and participation. And it's just leveled the crime statistics. It's leveled every felony type crime statistic in Camden, and it's going to do wonders for anyone that copies that model. And it needs to be done. I wouldn't even just say in urban areas, it needs to be done if you have Black Lives Matter protesters that are going against a riot squad, you're going to need to seriously consider implementing their reforms.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want an insight into Camden, there was a documentary about Cory Booker. This is actually how I first heard about Cory Booker. And I'm trying to look this up, but he ran again. It's called Street Fight. It's a great documentary about his 2002 election. And Newark and Camden are close together. And basically, Newark was falling apart, but they're like, at least we're not Camden.
Yeah.
So here's, I think,
By the way, I met Booker one time. It was awesome.
Really?
Yeah, at an airport.
Like? Really?
I was at Newark Airport, and this was after once he was, I don't think he was senator yet, but I forget. But he, I mean, he was fairly prominent.
He was a mayor
point.
Then before, right?
Yeah. I think he was still mayor, possibly. And I was sitting there waiting for my plane, and he was sitting like 2-3 seats over from me, and you know, not drawing much attention. And I'm not like a big like, oh type of guy, right? But I was
selfie.
Like, yeah. But I leaned over to him like, you're Cory Booker, right? And he's like, yeah. It's like, nice to meet you, you know, and all this. And then, you know, let him be. But then shortly thereafter, like as soon as I like kind of outed him, like all sorts of people started
came out.
Yeah.
And then later I'm like, I'm sorry, dude.
I mean, he's been a guy that's gone out on a limb because he worked with Rand Paul on minimum sentencing reform. Mm-hmm. And he's stuck his neck out there.
No, I like
no
Booker.
Sense.
I like
he's one
Booker.
Of the few Democrats I like.
Yeah.
Because he seems rational. He believes what he believes. But at the same time, he's also not an asshole.
Well, he's a worker and a reformer. Like a lot of people won't go out on that ledge with Rand Paul. Like right. even like Bernie Sanders or someone like Hillary Clinton, they won't go. They're just not willing to go out on that ledge. And for him, there wasn't a second thought.
Yeah,
I'll go to Howard University and put on a program with him because we're both on the same side on this one. And like that's the future of if America's going to make the right reforms. It's going to be Senate leadership like Cory Booker and Rand Paul going out on those ledges and making it look okay and finding, you know, a Ron Wyden too
Ron
to
Wyden,
come over,
absolutely.
You know, and then a Ted Cruz hopefully comes around and Thomas Massey somehow makes it to the Senate. And then you're really looking at like reforms that will put us on a right path rather than hearing appeals to law and order.
Yeah.
You know, that are only going to make it worse.
Yeah. Because what Donald Trump's approach really just emboldens white people, old white people who want to conserve. I mean, if you, I
tell you though, it's appealing to African Americans in levels that are incredible.
Well,
because he talks about cutting
Don
in, he goes, what do you have? I mean, if you
Don
look at the polling
King
right
doesn't
now,
count.
No, if you look at the polling right now, Hillary's down to 71% with African Americans and Trump's up to 24,
sure,
which is 8 points above Romney. And so you look at it and you say, well, there is part of the masculinity of Trump appeals to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of like the most consistently high polling thing among the African American supporters he has. But if you look at it, he's going in like he did in Gary, Indiana back in the 90s. This place is corrupt and awful.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make it great again. Right. I'm going to rebuild it. Yada, yada, yada.
Make Gary great again.
Right. Because it was the Trump Princess, which was supposed to be the riverboat casino that he was going to have up in Gary, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an element of he's going to come into these urban areas and fix the urban plight, even if it's just lip service and a promise. The Democrats say, I feel your pain, but they don't really offer any solutions other than things like the Community Reinvestment Act, which has done nothing but keep bank lending out of those areas and create food deserts.
Yeah. So I spent a large portion of the last 2 or 3 months reading through Taylor Branch's look at the size of the books over there, the black ones on the brown bookshelf there. I mean, those are big books. Reading through the Taylor Branch series, Pillar of Fire, Parting the Waters at Canaan's Edge, and watching Eyes on the Prize, which was the PBS documentary about the Civil Rights Movement. And when you really go back and you look at the Civil Rights Movement from the mid-50s to essentially the end of Martin Luther King, his life, that kind of ended the Civil Rights Movement and it moved into social justice land. You really learn a lot about our time when you go back and you research the Civil Rights era. At all different levels, you see the panic in white people. you see the way that movements are effective and not effective. And I was watching that last night, and the thing that jumped out to me is, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King and the SCLC and Ralph Abernathy and SNCC in the early days under John Lewis, they went from the Montgomery bus boycotts through to the mid-60s to like 65, and more progress was made in that 10-year span on civil rights because of the use of nonviolence. And once Stokely Carmichael got control of SNCC and was elected to the head of SNCC and started talking about black power, and you know, Malcolm X in 63-64 started talking about, you know, by any means necessary, and started saying, like, sort of the Spangle versus Maya approach. Okay, if you are being aggressed against, Maya believes that, you know, the police are aggressive, are violating the NAP. Therefore, we have every right to kill cops, which I couldn't disagree with that view more. I don't believe that all cops are bad. I think that I totally agree with.
I will go on record as a candidate and say I yeah. also disavow that.
Yeah, like it's some of these cop block people
out there on that ledge.
Yeah, I think some of these cop block people they just get it wrong, and because they're ignorant of how movements actually become effective. The second the SCLC and SNCC started to diverge, John Lewis left SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Once the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee started advocating violence or threatening violence, that's when the rallies and the marches all became, will there be violence? Mm-hmm. Not look at the poverty and the injustice. And I watched that last night and I just thought, you know what? That is completely illustrative of what Martin Luther King Jr. taught, which is that nobody knows what happened in Charlotte. We don't know who got killed or who killed them. Turns out it was a black cop killing a black man. And
no footage.
No footage, or at least it's not being released.
Yeah, it's not being released. That is just the worst.
The command structure is mostly black, and I think is there a black mayor?
In Charlotte?
I thought I read that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was thinking of the Republican governor issued a pretty incendiary statement about authorizing the National Guard.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it is an African-American mayor.
But check it out. See, yeah. And so, you know, I heard Al Sharpton spinning that as this is even our brothers who are in the midst of these institutions carry out institutional racism. He's not totally wrong, but it's also Al Sharpton, so I have to disagree. But the fact is that what you see last night, the newspapers are not talking about the institutions that are killing black bodies at a astronomically higher number than other races. That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about, why are all these black people rioting? Look at them. And this is what Martin Luther King, and I know that we're three white guys, so I get it, but...
Well, I'm Native American.
You're Native American. I'm 116th Cherokee Choctaw, but...
Charlotte's mayor is a white female.
Oh, okay.
Really? What's her name?
Jennifer Roberts.
Is she a Democrat or a Republican? Yes. Okay.
So you look at it and you go, if we want social change at any level and any issue... Martin Luther King is where you start. And you look at how society just starts evolving, and I think we're now at the beginning of the fracturing. We're now entering a period where we're not, people say, oh, this is like 1968. We're not even close. We're not even to the Watts riots. We're not, I mean, if you look through the 60s, especially the late 60s, because you have to understand, 68 was an incredibly catastrophic year for the American people. Mm-hmm. You had the Tet Offensive, where we realized we were getting our ass kicked in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You had the My Lai Massacre. You had Martin Luther King Jr. get killed. You had Robert Kennedy get killed. After JFK.
The fires at the Democratic National Committee convention.
The riots at the convention.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's when it all started. And then the summer of 69, it got worse. And
we did land on the moon.
Into the 70s.
Oh boy.
But we are really way back in like 1959, 1960 in terms of the new civil rights, which I would term as privacy and also police brutality.
Militarization.
And I think that they're both tied into... Yeah, militarization in terms of overseas wars, treating Americans like they are the enemy, and also the militarization of the police.
Oh, the police force, yeah.
And I think people are starting to finally converge. And libertarians can build a coalition around these issues. When you really look at what is happening and what we're talking about and why we feel less safe, it's because we're now starting to realize something is wrong, but we don't have the answers, we don't have solutions. We're just kind of like, oh my God, we got to fix this, but we don't know how yet.
I, I was reflecting on some of this morning. A friend of mine from college posted some article, and I read it this morning. I thought it had some good prescient points. I mean, it was just, you know, an article, you know, an essay by somebody, but it made me start thinking about, we've got some very interesting psychological, generational aspects going on, right? And so I know you guys are both millennials, right? Mm-hmm. I'm barely Gen X. I'm a little bit older than you guys, but not by much. I'm kind of on the...
You're much grosser.
Yeah, much grosser. Yeah, we're kind of gross, us Gen Xers, right? But... But, you know,
trying to look hip in your purple shirt. It's like you beat up a gay youth pastor for that shirt.
That's how you treat guests.
There you go.
It's a like purple with
it's gingham.
Purple with cowboy flaps on the boobies.
What? Oh, yeah, what are those called? Mistake,
breast
part, yeah,
breast but. Pockets.
But
did you just assume his gender?
Yes. So anyways, your thoughtful point was.
We grew up, at least, you know, most of Gen X, at least the later half and you know, the older millennials, right, of this kind of post-civil rights era, right? And so through the 80s and you know, most of the 90s, yeah, there was the Rodney King stuff, but most of what we were taught, at least I feel, was, you know, be colorblind. There's no difference between, we can't talk about difference between white and black because we have this history of racism. And so it was almost this knee jerk reaction back the other way that has been institutionalized amongst, you know, people between the ages of, I don't know, 20 and 45 or something. Right?
A willful ignorance in an effort to not be seen as racist.
Yes.
Hoping
it would go away.
It's like the Holocaust in Germany. Yeah. They didn't teach it.
Yeah,
it wasn't spoken about. You didn't talk about it. And now you have Mein Kampf, you know, now that it's finally being reprinted.
Like my dad never talked about, you know, the civil rights riots or anything like that. No, he lived in, you know, northern farmland in Illinois and stuff. But like, so, you know, now that there's this awareness of what's going on, largely because of technology and media and things like that, I think have a lot to do with it. A lot of us are stuck with like, opening our eyes in different ways for the first time in many ways.
Well, it's sort of like as a white person, it's like you're popping your head up. Am I allowed to say anything here?
Yeah. Well, you were taught that way for a long time, right?
Yeah, like this is all going on, but like
you mentioned earlier, the whole thing, even with Harry saying, oh, he would have criticized you, just say black.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I know. And it's so ingrained to say African-American. I have to think about it every time.
Because if you say black, you're like, oh, that's harsh. I don't want to be harsh and be seen as racist.
That's a commentary on
their
skin color.
And I think my age, being a little bit older than you, I think I was, you know, it was more used to saying black when I was younger, right? The whole African, like, no, let's say African-American came a little bit old. Like I had matured enough, right, that it wasn't as culturally, socially ingrained to say it. But yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, and I like
what... It's a phenomenon.
I like what Gary Johnson has said about this on the campaign trail, right? Because he's caught some flack for being outright and saying Black Lives Matter, right? And
not all lives matter.
And he's like, yeah, Black Lives do matter. And I've had my head in the sand on this, right? And he's done research. And so, you know, no Gary plug here on purpose. But I mean, I applaud him for like being willing. And that's been
he's fired up about it.
Yeah.
Last night on PBS, he was interviewed by
Gwen Ifill.
Yeah, Gwen Ifill. And that was the most lit up and animated I've seen Gary Johnson's. Like on a policy point in a long time.
I'm sorry.
That and immigration. He gets fired up on immigration too.
Because immigration is a dumb thing to be mad about. It's not a real issue. Yep. It is an emotional issue and it raises money and it clearly can drive you to the presidency, but it isn't as big of an issue.
Fly.
Right. Right. In a private jet. But we should be... We have some negative reviews on iTunes from people who think that we are liberal shills because we will occasionally talk about Black Lives Matter. It was after episode 160 where we tried to sit down with two guys who had spent at least half their life in prison. One of them admits to being there. You know, admits his crimes, or most of them, and then another one who maintains his innocence. But I got some hate mail for, I looked up their crimes. I still have no idea what they went to jail for. I didn't want to know, and we didn't want to announce it because we didn't want to taint the process. We wanted you to understand, and some people did look it up, and, you know, they were accused of some pretty awful crimes, apparently. And why would you have that person on? Why would you talk to them? Why would you? Because these are human beings and they know how the system works and I don't.
Yeah.
And
because I'm a white male.
Because I'm a white male and I'm not Castile. What's his first name?
Philando
yeah. Castile, who's been pulled over 52 times for bullshit reasons in 3 years.
For DWB.
And then just end up dead. You know, one of our best friends, Christine, she's half black, half white. And she says, I get pulled over all the time and I don't fuck around. Harry, all the time, our black correspondent here on the show. You know, it was the night of the Castile shootings. And he said, I don't feel comfortable leaving my house with my gun. I don't feel comfortable exercising my Second Amendment rights because of, you know, and I think we as white people have to try and understand at the very least, and at the most try and do something about it. I think if you look at the civil rights movement, you needed the Kennedys. You needed the privileged white men of power who could grease the wheels. You needed somebody who had been one of the major blockers of civil rights when he was the Senate president.
Is the Lyndon Civil Rights Act, though, something that was good? Can a law make you more free?
Let's not get sidetracked.
I'm not sidetracked, but like that's so like.
But
the conundrum
I'm saying is what you have to understand is the not necessarily the legal implications, but the moral, ethical, and
cultural
inspirational standards of Lyndon B. Johnson standing up in front of the Congress saying we shall overcome. Martin Luther King burst into tears at that moment because here's a man who had actively worked against his freedom when he was in the Senate, now taking up the mantle. Now, LBJ was one of the most evil people on the planet. I personally believe that LBJ had JFK, MLK, and RFK killed. I think he had all these people killed for his own power. I think that his commitment to civil rights was only because he wanted to get reelected.
Political gains. Yeah.
Right. But you cannot ignore that citizens of all races,
right?
Citizens of all races have to come together to start fighting these injustices. Now, as libertarians, is something like the Civil Rights Act a good use of the government? We'll leave that to a different episode to debate because that's not what we're talking about. But no. I think it might actually fit. So,
well, it does kind of because the other conundrum I've been battling with is we are at all time lows in crime.
Sure.
Yeah. Arguably, we have the greatest surveillance apparatus, police militarization, and all. You know, correlation isn't causation.
Correct.
But that is the conundrum of, dang it.
Is it
we
working?
Have all this and we have extremely low crime. Oh, you know, do draconian laws work? Yada, yada, yada. Now, as libertarians, we're violently opposed to it. It just sucks that there's a correlation between all-time lows in crime and the biggest police state and surveillance state you can imagine.
Right.
That is the problem for libertarians. Like, if you look at last night, you look at the riots, in that moment it was anarchy. It was absolute anarchy because they were protecting, you know, they were holding down the fort to an extent, but they weren't going out and pursuing the protesters. Now, looting went on. Looting goes on all the time.
Sure.
Regardless. The point is, though, in that period of a lack of remediation, because a lot of the crimes will go unpunished, is that good for liberty? And to what extent do you need a modicum of order and a platform of peace for you to exercise your civil liberties and your individual liberties? Because if you don't have them, you are in a constantly protective state trying to defend them. Yeah. And that's not good for anyone.
No, I think that's fair. And I've always been open that I'm a minarchist and not an anarchist at heart. And actually, you know, the way I met Chris, or Chris met me, or I forget which way, but I was writing a lot at the time. And that's how I came to, you know, evolve my political thinking and ultimately leading to political involvement. And I remember writing an article about, you know, taking the concepts of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, and applying them to a structure of governance and what that means in terms of constituting good government, and essentially arguing like why, from a very libertarian perspective, that the social safety net is necessary, right? I mean, it, you know, so because
To an extent,
right? But I mean, the higher you go up the triangle of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and the more you've already had met and fulfilled, the more you are averse to having that revert back. Okay, and so to this point, you know, we do need that protection because, you know, when you don't have any safety at all, right, and no remediation at all, then, you know, then you don't have liberty. Now, sorry, whether or not that needs to be performed by the state versus private, and to what extent, those are all, you know,
and that's largely what I believe, that there needs to be a safety net. There will be a need. There will be a safety net. But does it have to be done by force? I think that's how most libertarians think.
There's two aspects. I mean, there's the economic safety net, right, which, you know, I will also say there needs to be some aspect of that. I'd love for it all to be privately funded and done through community and done through family and all that type of stuff. But then there's also the security safety net, right? Like
property protection, property rights. Exactly. I mean, and that's where the court system comes into play. Now, the other where we've gone astray is police militarization has turned property right defense into an offensive game rather than a defensive game. Mm-hmm. It isn't about protecting the public interest or, you know, upholding safety and order. Now it is, they're going out and it's almost like Minority Report to an extent. Mm-hmm. Like we're not there. It's not, you know, preemptive by any means based on cognition and dreams, but it is, they are actively searching for things that, where there are problems that don't exist and are not going to exist. Mm-hmm. And that's a violation of rights.
Absolutely.
That is a violation of rights every single time. And the problem is the police don't get prosecuted. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Police never get prosecuted. If you want to fully, the law can work both ways. You can apply the law to police officers just as if they were regular citizens, and you would you'd see these types of crimes plummet.
I agree.
It would not happen whatsoever. It's just like if we applied the surveillance apparatus to the people that work in government. You would not see any of the cronyism. You wouldn't see like all the, you know, the Anthony Wieners. You might see Anthony's Wiener a little bit more often, but you know, you wouldn't. Well, you would.
It, some,
you
know, guys in prison are going to be seeing his wiener, right, because he's going to jail for being a child.
That's the problem. That's the dilemma. The dilemma is, yes, theoretically, any law can make any group of people safer and offer you greater liberty to an extent until it encroaches upon what you know,
sure,
encroaches on something. But those same laws have to apply to the government. The government operates outside the bounds of the laws that it's in charge of authorizing and enforcing.
Yeah. I mean, and then this is we talk about the Second Amendment a lot and the First Amendment, but you know, the Fourth and the Sixth, you know, are, I think it's the Sixth, you know, it's incredibly important. And becoming increasingly important, you know, to me as I look at things, as well as being, you know, more and more under threat, especially as we talk about conversations like this, right?
Like 10th is gone.
Yeah, forget the 10th.
It's been like a 9th. Slow dominoes just, yeah, knocked over, you know, and now we're at, you know, really we're at the 4th.
But being, you know, being protected from privacy, you know, securing your person against, you know, and needing, you know, you should get a warrant, right? But the concept of due process is, I think, lost oftentimes in a lot of these discussions. And this goes back to, like, common law, the roots of, you know, what this is
code.
All about, right?
Yeah.
And I think what frustrates me, you know, in you know, reviewing the interwebs and being engaged in the political discussion is how often people are willing to just forgo due process and be like, well, that guy was doing X, Y, and Z, so,
well,
you know.
There's a situation, I mean, there's a clear-cut situation here in Indiana with one of our congressional candidates where there is a very clear case once all the facts come out where if you hear the story, you go, wow, this guy didn't do anything wrong. And a cop thought he flipped him off. And the cop got real hot and basically started beating him up, and the guy fought back. And when he fought back, he got arrested, now is charged with two felonies. And his two opponents in the race refuse to appear in a debate now because they won't be on the stage with someone who beats up cops and hates cops. That couldn't be further from the case with this particular person. Mm-hmm. That isn't who he is. He didn't do anything wrong except turn the wrong way out of a gas station and have a cop have a bad day. And the two people who are running to be congressman, congresswoman, respectively, didn't give him due process. They just assume he's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
They just assume that he did it. They side with the government apparatus. and they're going to do whatever they can to grandstand and support that cop, even though the cop is wrong. And they're not willing to hear or understand what actually happened.
Well, let's look at Tulsa.
And those are the type of people that are making your laws. And you know why they have that? It's because that's how we are. If you hate Donald Trump and you hate Hillary Clinton, it's because they reflect our society. You know, it's not that... I think creative people, and I think people like... Let's take comedians. Comedians that... it's not that comedians are necessarily brilliantly creating something out of nothing. They become avatars that reflect a society's attitudes
in social commentators
in the best way possible, and that's how they become big. Donald Trump is taking off because Donald Trump is playing the right chords in a society that largely reflects Donald Trump's personality. He is us. So we,
he's not us.
Well, not,
but he's
a little you, but not me.
I actually like where I just, I mean, granted side, but like, you know, libertarian, I foresee a time when borders are necessary in order to preserve freedom. This is kind of like we talked about with Marx and the idea of like a global class consciousness and whether you can have like an individual consciousness mm-hmm. of people. And, you know, like, that's why I'm not against like Donald Trump's idea that you have to protect your borders, because if you have a political institution and anyone's allowed to participate that wants to, you can have a coalition of people, if it's not a constitutional republic, or even if it is with the amendment process, that can take over your political institutions and get rid of the liberty that you've codified into law.
The problem is that the...
Is it likely to happen? No, yeah, but right, I'm saying that there is a justification for it. Like, it's not like open borders is... the same, it's not a panacea, because the difference between Switzerland and Poland is Switzerland has natural borders and they didn't get taken over by the Nazis sure. or the Russians, and Poland got marched over and fought over and divvied up.
Right. But the problem is the apparatus, the state, it's just too big. It's unmanageable. It's unwieldy. And mm-hmm. we're the counter to what you're saying is that government and the state is much too broad and large.
Right. It's top heavy.
Right. What I believe is that, yeah, you do have a community, and that community sets its rules and laws, and they decide. And yeah, you may want to live in Plainfield, but not in Indianapolis, where it's a little more communist.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to live where James Neese lives. That's for sure. He wants some sort of
helicopters.
Well, James is a communitarian. He wants communist libertarianism, and that's not my bag, baby.
Anarcho-syndicalist, bruh.
Yeah. So let's take a quick break. I just want to mention the civil rights and the Taylor Branch books, which are awesome. I also want to mention a book called by Jason Sokol, S-O-K-O-L, called There Goes My Everything: White Southerners in the Age of the Civil Rights. And what we so often here, when we discuss the civil rights movements or any group, it's you hear about the people who won. You hear about Martin Luther King. You hear about Malcolm X.
Winners write history.
Right. You hear about the oppressor overcoming the oppressed overcoming the oppressor. And what Jason has done in this book called There Goes My Everything is right from the perspective of the white Southerner, and really echoed, and the reason I thought of this is echoed kind of what Matt said. There are a lot of guys who served in the military who grew up, and being racist was just how it was. That's, you didn't know black people. My great grandparents died in their 90s, mid 90s, back in 97, 98. And, you know, they grew up in rural southern Indiana. And there's a story, probably his family mythology, where they came to the big city in the 1970s or 60s. And my dad got in an elevator with him, and my great-grandmother leans over and goes, "Oh, Miles, that's one of those Negroes we've heard about." Now, I highly doubt that. I'm pretty sure my dad had to be making that up. But
nah.
It might not. It's probably not far from the truth.
I don't, yeah.
But
I've seen Borat when he calls Alan Keyes a real-life chocolate face. High fives him.
So...
High five.
But, yeah, high five.
You know, it really talks about how guys went into the military and they were around black guys for the first time. And some of the, just, it outlines the perspective of the white Southerner and takes the argument that we spend too much time examining how this affected these massive radical changes. Because when you have segregation, whether black or white, and then within 2 years you have no segregation. That's quite a change.
Yeah.
Your government, and it's libertarians will face that too. It's like, as a culture of people who have never been politically active, who have never governed, the second you start winning and you start flooding the government, the Republicans and Democrats are going to figure out how to deal with you, and you're going to have to figure out how to deal with them.
Yeah.
So I think that this is an important book to understand kind of the other side of the equation, not only just the Klansmen, but also just regular white people who, once they really understood what their government was doing, they went, oh, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. They should vote. That's not how this is supposed to go.
Well, so. You know, and this echoes a personal experience as well, and ties back to a little bit of what I was saying earlier about the, you know, the generational evolution here, okay? And the fact that this kind of happened, and, you know, especially here in the North, we didn't talk about it, right? You know, when we were growing up, our parents didn't talk about this stuff, right? So it was a little bit hidden.
Graduated late 70s. They weren't, I mean, they were kids when they weren't even born when the civil rights movement was happening.
But there weren't this story, at least among us northern white folk, right, for the most part. But one thing we did hear about as kids was apartheid in South Africa, right? And I went to South Africa on business, and the benefit of going to the apartheid museum. And it was just so striking and emotional, right? And now reflecting right here at this moment, it's weird that actually struck me and was more emotional in ways than what is even happened here, because I just didn't have that same awareness. I knew this horrible stuff was going on in South Africa. You heard about it, right? You know, for the Sun City, don't play Sun City and all this stuff. And I go there, and there's the apartheid museum, and I remember this one room, and it had like 100 nooses hanging from the ceiling or something like this, right? And every noose represented someone that had hung. But then on the wall, there were plaques that represented who all those people were and the date in which the hanging happened. And they were like 1996, 1990s. And it's like, oh my God, this was just like 8 years ago, right? Because I was there in like 2004 or whatever. And it's like, holy cow, right? I'm here right now in this culture right now where this horrible thing is now over. And you could tell it was a little bit more fresh.
Yeah, fresh wound.
Right? But then seeing it, I mean, and I haven't had that type of experience here. Right?
Well, no,
which
I mean,
it's kind of sad.
Look who the hero was from that movement for white people, like our parents, JFK.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Martin Luther King Jr. He was a great icon. They was revered, but it wasn't anything like JFK was. Yeah. And JFK didn't usher it through, but he championed the cause. And, you know, obviously, you know, tragic events happened. But that's the real difference is for our – that's the cultural difference. For our parents, it was JFK.
Or Bobby.
Yeah. Right.
It was a Kennedy. It wasn't an African-American or a black person.
Right. Because there still was a distrust. And a large portion of white Southerners and white Northerners, And the press reflected this view. They looked at Martin Luther King as someone not to be trusted.
Rabble rouser.
Well, it's why Edgar Hoover tailed him all the time and was basically spying on him all the time. I mean, you talk about Edward Snowden and the NSA. J. Edgar Hoover was just as bad.
he just did it with people, not electronics.
But I mean, MLK has even at this point hit a point of a certain amount of reverence. But then after that, it's like
who?
Nothing. Right?
Sure. The other point is that once Martin Luther King started talking about the Vietnam War, that was the end of the civil rights movement. And he killed the movement. And all those friendly whites said,
he's unpatriotic.
Oh, he's unpatriotic. See, they were right about him. He is a communist.
Yeah.
And so there was still that siloing back then that we have now. One thing that I'm worried about is that when Michael Brown happened in Ferguson, I think a lot of whites looked at it and said, well, there's, you know, he's just doing this, he's doing that. Once we got to Philando Castile and you saw that video, that's when you went,
oh my,
holy shit.
Is this my country?
And that was personally for, it was Eric Garner. Yep. And
Tamir Rice, to me, the 12-year-old, a 12-year-old kid's just...
To me, it was Castile. It was just seeing it that close. That's when I went, these last two instances, I can't tell you their name. And one thing that I worry about is that, you know, I'm a well-informed individual that spends at least an hour a day trying to read through the news. And I see a lot of news, but I'm so focused on the political news that I want to follow that I don't know the names of the people that just got killed.
Terrence something.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what happened in Tulsa. I don't know what happened.
Dude, that one is horrible.
Yeah. I did see the video. Yeah. What was the copter video where, is that Tulsa?
That's Tulsa.
Yeah.
So they had there's a copter video and a dash cam video.
Yeah. I've seen both. Yeah. And so
about the rioting, you know, that's what's funny is it's the rioting that leads to the press coverage when it just shouldn't be at all.
Sure. And that's the exact opposite. It should be about the deaths and why is this happening.
When you're having riots in Charlotte, you're at a precipice. I mean, it is, it's just different. It's different than Baltimore. It's different than, you know, Ferguson. St. Louis. It's just different because it's Charlotte, North Carolina. And granted, it is Tobacco Row. You know, and there is that, you know, cultural or that institutional racism probably in separation of society dating back to that. But man, Charlotte is seen as a new age city. It's seen as a research city, science city. It is not considered a place of awful race relations.
North Carolina was always considered forward thinking and part of the New South. As opposed to South Carolina, which still wants the Confederate flag over the state house. But so one thing that I'm worried about is that we're just not going to care, you know, but I just don't think we're going to have any choice. We're not at the point where we're not even to the LA riots yet. We're
but we
not
don't have
to the
answers. That's the killer. I mean, Camden worked, you know, it's working. I shouldn't say it worked, but that's the killer is, I mean, if we tried affirmative action, that made it worse.
Yeah.
I mean, Harvard's now even reviewing their admission process for black students because of the, you know, I guess weighting it too high on their race and then seeing a slight downtick in the test scores and the grades that they're admitting. And we're at a point where now what?
So Black Lives Matter has come out with Campaign Zero, which is a 10-point piece of policy solutions, of which, you know, I can easily get behind the spirit of 80-90% of it or more, if not all 10 points, right? And there's a lot of good stuff there, you know, demilitarization of the police, and
mandatory.
Ending the drug war is mandatory.
What it stems from. That is the thing that we have connected as libertarians and people who think about this stuff, but the mass population has not yet connected.
Made that connection, right?
They haven't yet. And once they do, we're going to see massive rapid change.
Or will they? Because ultimately, a lot of people watched last night that are baby boomers, and they were like, "Man, we need law and order. We're gonna need more force. We're gonna need yada yada yada." And as long as they're the biggest voting block, it's gonna be a while. And they're not dying anytime soon because they're a young generation. I mean, they participate. Millennials don't. Gen X does more than millennials by probably about half.
We got to get the millennials participating.
But millennials don't, and millennials just are apathetic.
But the baby boomers used to be the millennials, right? I mean, in the 60s.
They were. John Kerry was up in Congress testifying over the, I mean, and now look, he's Secretary of State brokering deals with Assad, having dinner with Assad in Damascus. I mean, how do you keep your idealism in a incredible, I mean, Barack Obama struggled with it. Arguably the most idealistic president since JFK comes in, has all these ideas
completely
for reform.
Squashed.
His political capital goes out the window within 2 years, and he just has to deal with a reality he had no idea existed.
Yeah.
Well, my theory with him, and this is, it's off topic, but like I think he got into the White House without the administrative apparatus around him. So he had to reach back to the existing establishment, the Clintons, and even like some of the leftover Bush, moderate type of stuff. Right. And then it's like, all right, boy, here's this is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
Right. And
it's like, Bill's calling the shots.
That's why I think, you know, we talked after the Snowden movie, we saw the Snowden movie. We loved it. Absolutely. Highly recommend it. I've got the poster on the wall here. You have a theory about Obama and his relationship to Ed Snowden.
Oh, yeah. Like, I still think that the president brokered... I think he's protecting him in Russia. Like, I think he could have... If he really wanted to force the issue, he could have had him. But I don't think... I think the president wants to pardon him, and he was willing to take the flack, but he wants him protected because he upholds his ideals.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope so. I mean, I had so much hope for Obama. I really did.
He said, like, I'm not going to, you know, fire up the jets to go get a hacker.
Yeah. Right.
And I just thought... In that moment when he said that, I thought, you're on his side. but you politically cost yourself with the health care, and you can't afford to take that risk going into an election year.
Which is why I think in terms of the issues that libertarians care about, he could end up being a great force for good
post-presidency.
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, I really thought...
UFOs.
I thought all along that Obama's initiatives would be around ending nuclear weapons. You know, he was big into
nuclear proliferation
with Luger. But
yeah.
I think that you look at this issue and you go, this could be an area where... But see, here's the problem is Obama can rise above it. He is that figure that can
transcend,
can cross the bridge between the white and the black community. Whereas a Jesse Jackson or an Al Sharpton or whatever leader kind of rises up.
The Siegels.
You know, like the Eric Dysons of the world, where it's all about, quote unquote, the community. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a Republican and a Democrat talking about Obamacare. It's like, no, we want to have a dialogue, but these dialogues are all leftists saying, you're going to agree with me and I'm right, not actually, let's hear each other and try to come to a mutual understanding. Yeah,
there's no room for a broker.
Right.
Yeah.
There just is. I mean, there isn't a room for Rand Paul. As I swear, he has put himself out there more than any other politician to try to broker it. And he's still the racist that opposed the Civil Rights Act on Rachel Maddow.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, because I look at it and I go, listen, the woman in Tulsa, you watch the Philando Castile video, you listen to that cop, you watch that cop. That cop is having a traumatic event in his life just as much as the girlfriend is, and obviously, but not neither of them as much as Castile. You watch this video of this female cop in Tulsa. She's having as much of an event as anybody else. There, I just don't think that all cops are racist out there hunting black people. I do think that there are certain cultural attitudes around blacks within... I shadowed with cops because I wanted to be a police officer when I was in high school. So I, through the high school, rode along with police officers. And I remember one police officer saying to me that after 15 years on the job, they just become awful people. Because what happens is you spend 90% of your time around the bottom 10% of the population, and you just become completely cynical and jaded. It's just like anybody who works in politics. You look at me, I've spent my entire adult life around the political apparatus, looking at it, working within it, talking to people about it.
And you don't believe there's a great American within the Indiana political apparatus?
No, I don't.
Even though they have ads that say it, they aren't.
I'm very cynical. I'm very skeptical of any real change. And I think police get that way as well. And... you have attitudes that become pervasive. I think it's so those attitudes have to change. But Jeff Ross was just on the Daily Show, and Jeff Ross did a special called Jeff Ross Roasts the Cops. And he went to a New York City Black Lives Matter rally to just see what it was about firsthand, get an experience. Next day he goes to Boston to ride with the BPD. They refused to let him ride with them because they had looked him up and they'd seen that he had been at a Black Lives rally. And so they didn't trust him. They said, no, you can't come with us. He had to buy him pizza to let him in before they would trust him. And so he just looks at it and he goes, listen, neither side will talk to each other.
Right.
And if you are the person who is trying to broker some sort of conversation, you become suspect to either side because there's information silos.
You're a political nomad.
Well, yeah.
Right. So Obama, it's, to me, is if he doesn't put greed ahead of everything else like the Clintons have, he could be a factor in helping end the drug war, reform some of these spying programs post-presidency, because you can do so much more when you're not in office.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and he's a fantastic campaigner. That will be the biggest part of the challenge, I think, right? Is how much will his draw as a campaigner for the Democratic Party get in the way of him really pushing change, right? I mean, and it may be 20 years before. I mean, because I think that's the part of I mentioned Jimmy Carter briefly, but seriously, like no president after Jimmy Carter has gone off to kind of do his own thing and really try to promote
a global initiative.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys covered that, I think, last week or the week before.
He did his own thing.
But it wasn't a cause.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, and Carter just came out, earlier this week to saying that Snowden should be pardoned.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, he suffered the exact same thing Barack Obama did. That's why there's so many comparisons there.
Yeah.
Is he came in as, you know, the engineer from Georgia that was going to bring his own team in, and they were going to do it. They're going to be technocratic governments. They were going to be best and brightest, you know, a new Camelot. Mm-hmm. And it, if you don't have institutional knowledge of the bureaucracy, you are dead day one. That's why you had President Obama having to rely on the Clintons, and you have George W. Bush having to rely on his dad's people.
Yep.
You cannot bring it.
Which is who Reagan had too.
It is. Yeah.
It was his dad.
They're
all
still here.
It was W or HW. Yeah.
I mean, then they were actually someone that they were new. The Reagans were the changing of the guard from the Bob Taft and the like the Rockefeller Republicans. Like they were a new Western.
Although
group.
There was a lot of holdovers. The holdovers from some Nixon holdovers.
Yep.
Right.
You had to.
Which was kind of critical there as well. And George H.W. Bush was kind of part of that world. I mean, having been a former CIA director.
Yeah, he was the operator.
He was.
Well, but it's because they all come from the think tank culture. You have the Brookings Institute and the
Council Heritage Foundation,
the Council on Foreign Relations, Heritage Foundation. Although that's fairly new. I mean, you look at the if you go back to the history, and I know that a lot of conspiracy theorists pick up on this, but I don't think it's conspiracy theory. It's very clear. Patrick Warburg. It was one of the Warburgs. I think it was Patrick. He's the guy that started the Fed, and then he started the Council on Foreign Relations to network all the nations together and provide staffing. And 50% of all cabinet members, like since the CFR started, have come regardless of party from the CFR. Mm-hmm. You have the Brookings Institution, who lays out policy.
American Enterprise Institute.
American Enterprise Institute. The Rand Corporation. The Wilson Center.
Yeah, the Rumsfeld. Yeah.
You've got all these different, you know, and then you've got the small think tanks, like the Goldwater Institute, the Sagamore Institute here in Indiana. We've got a couple other small think tanks. Mike Pence was head of the Hoover. Was it Hoover? I think it was Hoover. Although the Hudson Institute was here, and then they moved to New York City after he ran it into the ground. And you know, but you've got this culture of think tanks, and so that's why the Kochs, quite frankly, in the early '80s, after they had given up on the Libertarian Party with Ed Clark, and they didn't get the results they wanted. That's why the Kochs built Reason, Cato, FEE, the Foundation for Economical Education, the Institute for Humane Studies, the Institute for Justice, and they started backing that culture of think tanks, you know, the Heritage Institution, because the right didn't have
placeholders
in think tanks, and they needed someone to combat that globalist mentality, and in the Brookings Institute, the Wilson
CFR.
CFR. Now, granted, Greg and I go to CFR and Brookings all the time. I go to think tanks all the time, and we look at it because there is great information.
Great.
There.
Yeah.
They write about things no one else is writing about. Like,
right.
You're not going to go and get like an in-depth review of the situation in Yemen and the Saudi and Iran tensions that are going on.
You know, as a libertarian, I first heard about the CFR as this big boogeyman and all this thing. And then I went to the website. I'm like, wow, this is good content.
They've got free reports. All I have to do is give my email address. Right. I'll give them my spam email address. Yeah. This is great.
Right. So if the enemy is going to give you free resources, but... You know, and this is my argument again, like, oh, Mitt Romney, he's going to join the Johnson administration. Well, great. Because the ultimate decider is Gary Johnson, not Mitt Romney.
He's
Mitt Romney's
decider.
Very capable. Yeah. and you, as a person who is involved in politics, you can decide what's true or not. You read it.
Well, I mean, you want competent people. That's been the problem so much is that, you know, if you even look at like Bush's administration, he didn't like Michael Brown, head of FEMA. You know, he didn't, or what was it? FEMA. He was the one that had a background in Arabian horse racing in the Middle East, and he's like, "Brownie, you're doing a hell of a job." You know, right. Like no, people are dying and getting raped in the Superdome, but whatever. but like that is cronyism to a T. Like I was talking to you. I would love a Gary Johnson administration and Bill Weld administration where Mitch Daniels is director of the OEMB, Rand Paul is Secretary of Defense, Ron Paul is Secretary of State. I mean, and they're, you know, and then you bring in Nick Gillespie to be press secretary.
Sure.
I mean, Matt Welch to be director of communications. I mean, you could build a hell of a staff with people that are non-fiscal or socially conservative Republicans with institutional knowledge, and then in the positions that are need to be more focused on messaging, like libertarian, and then policy circles, libertarian appointees, and build one of the best damn administrations in the history of the American Republic.
Sure.
But, and it would be incredible.
And so that's why the Kochs started these institutions. And so when libertarians like get all pissed off about the Kochs, I just shake my head and go, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, because if we actually, if Gary Johnson got elected tomorrow or Ron Paul got elected president, who do you think staffing the tens of thousands? Because
yes,
make no mistake, when a person gets elected to an executive office, that's when the graft kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When Mike Pence took over for Mitch Daniels, libertarian-leaning Republican, has all but endorsed Gary Johnson because he can't, because of his deal with Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Republican Party that had been successful and had
moderate technocrat
revolutionized Indiana government over 8 years. You know what happened? Mike Pence replaced all of Mitch's people with his people. And that's because all those people that worked hard out on your campaign, they get a job in the government. And so I watched friends of mine who I had known forever get jobs, and I'm going, you have no idea how to run transportation.
Lion Rob Kendall.
Right. He's a great example. Rob Kendall was, what did he get appointed
something
to?
Something of the pharmacy, like the board of pharmacy in Indiana.
Like here's a guy with no medical experience.
He doesn't even cook meth. He is not qualified for that job.
Right. But he went out and did some canvassing for Mike Pence, and he gets a job managing the pharmacy bureaucracy.
Thank you, Andrew Jackson.
Yes. Right. And so, when the libertarians finally win, who are we going to graft to? You know what I mean? So
let's win first.
Right.
But I mean, we do need to be thinking about
Greg
it because
Lenz.
Oh God, I would be out immediately, but I'd be happy
I'd be
to give
happy to be press secretary.
I was thinking Gary got at, if you watch the 60 Minutes episode, Gary and Bill got asked if you had ideas on who you would staff it with. We can't say no.
Yeah.
He said he didn't. And I thought, you cannot do that. You want Justin Amash as the director of the CIA. I want,
yeah, but they can't name those names.
They can.
They should.
They have nothing to lose.
Right.
I hear you. But yeah, but Weld at least jumped in with,
he said,
like,
he had ideas of people who have advisors on foreign policy and he's worked with in think tanks. But when I heard Gary say that, I said, no.
Yeah.
Ron Paul as Federal Reserve Chairman.
Yeah.
It's what he's wanted his whole life. You put Rand Paul, Secretary of Defense. I want Justin Amash in charge of the CIA. I want Thomas Massie in charge of the FBI. I want Andrew Napolitano as the head of the Justice Department.
How much of a bump when he said he'd put him on the Supreme Court did he get? Gary Johnson got a huge bump when he said he wanted Napolitano on the Supreme Court. And what you ended up happening was Weld emasculating the presidential candidate by saying, I know more than you. And it just was, it was bad for him. I thought, by and large, the interview went well.
It was great.
I think that if you didn't know those two, like most of the people watching it, you thought, wow, I really am going to look these guys up. And I bet their Google ratings shot through the roof. But I think, you know, as libertarian pundits who are sitting there watching it, we're going, man, there's a missed opportunity, you know. So,
well, it's the difference between coming in and having the ideas and having a plan you present to the American people that's ready to go day one,
yeah,
and being a philosophical party with general ideas and not concrete details of how things are going to change.
Yeah.
And that is just what infuriates me, because I didn't care about Aleppo. It's whatever.
Yeah.
But then I see a meme that says, it's a remake of it, that says, what are you going to do? What would you do about the Chelsea bombing? And it's Gary Johnson saying, I think we need to get her out of there. I thought that is just perfection, because that's going to be the lingering effect, which isn't bad, because we just need him to get 10, 15%, hopefully, or even 5. But, you know, at the same time, like, I can't wait for someone to walk in and say, this is what we're going to do in our first 100 days. This is what the plan looks like. And it's believable on every element and people take it seriously.
Yeah. I mean, what we're missing, and I think why a lot of libertarians are lukewarm on Gary, like if you look at the Progressive Party of 100 years ago, and Eugene Debs was really making advances in the election against Woodrow Wilson, to the point that he eventually got put in jail under the Espionage Act by Wilson. You know, I can remember right now, 100 years after it was written in 1912 in the Indianapolis convention of the Socialist Party platform, the 10 things that they would do to enact. It was the 10 things on their platform. One of them was referendums. They got that passed in California. So all you people who say, oh, well, we need referendums so the people can decide. That direct democracy is socialist. Removing the senators from appointment by the legislators.
State legislatures.
Right. To the voters.
Popular vote, right.
The whole point of the Senate was to be a stopgap. So
to protect from the passions of the mobs.
Right. And so which was what the House was meant to be, the cauldron. And then the Senate was meant to be the cooling effect. And once that was removed, well, by gosh, you got
Lion Ted.
You got well, once that was passed, you got perpetual war. You got the Federal Reserve Act. You got the Great Society, the income tax. You got
prohibition Obama, pretty much right there. As
Obamacare.
Well.
You got
taking us off the gold standard.
Right.
Which is, I mean, Nixon. Ultimately has, you know, that has, you know, even though that's nerdy and economic, like it's that's insidious. What facilitates the rest of it.
Yeah, it's robbing us of our wealth.
And I mean, that facilitates the ability to wage wars and print dollars. Like that facilitates the ability to do the Great Society.
It also
society.
Creates income disparity, right? Which people Every don't time. Think about, right?
No,
because I'm a math guy, right? So, right. But if the economy is growing at 3% and somebody else is going at 5%, that's going to multiply a lot.
Yeah,
over time.
It has an amplification. Effect yeah. on those that are closest to the Federal Reserve.
Damn exponents.
I was just talking to a mutual friend of ours. She's getting an accounting degree, and she's very good at personal finances, all that stuff. And I said, yeah, I want to pay down all this debt, and then I want to start saving money. And she goes, why would you do that, you idiot? Don't you? And she's not a libertarian. She's like, why would she? She's just a pure political. She's not even really that political. Yeah, she just looks at it from like, here's the smart investing strategies. Yeah. She goes, you're an idiot if you save money.
You're losing money.
You're just you might as being well bury robbed. It. Yeah, she's like, you should go back and invest in your education, and you should take out loans and do this. And I'm like, we are on two different like, as and with most things, we're on two different planets.
Well, it's a fixed
save,
mindset.
But you should invest. Yeah, that's the difference. I mean, the connotation of save with okay, I'm going to just get the flat interest rate that I'm getting from the bank. That is not great financial management.
No, you might as well say just make more money.
Yeah, but investing.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to put it into an index fund or even a, you know, even at worst, a money market fund, like yeah. at the bare minimum, I mean, I know that's not like it's barely nothing,
that's
but
pretty much cash.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but you know, it's accessible. And so like, you know, that's just the nature of the beast though. But I feel like too, we need to touch upon Chelsea because that's a tough one for libertarians.
Yeah. So I think there
and
is
it's once a, more for Lion Rob.
You know, we've got, obviously, we're finally at a point where the war, we're going over there to attack them there so they won't attack us here. But we're finally at a point where they're attacking us here. We've got a situation where the lone wolf, like this guy was the bomber in Chelsea. I think it was him. It was not the Minnesota guy. He was basically saying, I've got, everybody in his whole family turned him into the FBI, and they looked at him and they said, "Ah, he's fine. It's fine." So the system that we've built clearly doesn't work.
No.
All this, if you watch Snowden, you're just like, "Holy crap! This is what they and that's not working." We're now living with perpetual terrorism, and there will be. But you know what? The thing is, it wasn't to me an outcrying of "We've got to do something. We've got to do something." It was literally Adam Glopnik, who wrote an article in the New York Times, basically said this was the great terrorist meh. Where it was just like you watch on the Daily Show the clip, the news clips where everybody's like, yeah, I'm really pissed off because I can't get my car out. I got to go to work. Mm-hmm. I need to go to the grocery. They're in my way. Like people are just inconvenienced by the. So it's not terrorism anymore. It's literally like just another random act.
Yeah.
Now maybe that's because it wasn't nobody lost their life or.
I think that plays a pretty good factor. But yeah.
I mean, do you know the 7 victims in the Minnesota stabbing? I don't.
We did see, I did look up
no deaths,
but except the stabber and 10 victims.
Sure.
But yeah, no names.
And I look at it and I'm watching all these, you know, de Blasio and everybody else, Cuomo, going, we don't know if this is terrorism or not yet. I was like, well, somebody intentionally set off a bomb to scare people or kill people. How's that not terrorism? Are you waiting to find out if they're Muslim or not? Because that's basically what I heard.
Yeah.
Are they brown? Because then it's terrorism.
Then it's terrorism.
If it's a kid with a bowl cut, then he's just a poor, mentally ill youth.
Hopefully not libertarian.
Well, mentally ill youth.
No, I mean, it is that's the I'll tell you that that was the danger we talked about, is that the more desperate you make an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda, the more you force it onto your territory and the more it makes it look like the security apparatus is necessary and the law and order are necessary. And if people had died, it would have probably been the event that would have tipped Trump over the top, you know, because Hillary made sure to flirt that, you know, she did a tightrope dance and made sure that, you know, she didn't blame minorities because right. there are good Muslims. And it's the same thing like when Charlotte there, you know, not all black people are, you know, going and shooting police. But, you know, Trump is going to appeal to people that are scared. And that's the danger of this election.
Fear.
It is people are scared because they don't recognize the country. It's psychological between generations and they vote. And if we're one more domestic terrorism incident to where Hillary Clinton is going to be down 5 points and she's going to be down 5 points going in.
And I'll tell you, the reason is that she won't call it what it is.
She won't.
And when you contrast her with her opponent, who's basically telling it like it is and feeding into the cultural memes around terrorism, whether true or not, but mostly true, you know, he feeds into the stereotypes. And then she is harder on her opponent than she is on the people that kill people.
Yeah.
Everybody goes, well, this is why we hate you. You make no sense. You know, everybody this week was going, I just don't know why all the millennials loved Obama and Bernie Sanders, but they don't love her. They love Gary Johnson. They love Donald Trump, but nobody likes Hillary Clinton. There's much hand-wringing, and I'll tell you why. It's because Hillary Clinton represents everything that millennials hate. Inauthenticity,
status quo,
ineffectiveness, the status quo, and we have been saddled by her and her specifically in her generation with a lot of bad shit. The economy collapses, wars, and then we got to pay for it, and our kids got to pay for it.
We'll never pay for it.
And then she lies to us on top of it. We just, like, fuck your institutions. We're trying to get rid of you.
Yeah. Why don't you guys just go?
We're going to vote in a 75-year-old socialist who's not going to make it 8 years because we hate you so much.
Yeah.
We're going to vote for a mentally ill man who has an orange skin and bad hair who is a reality TV star because we hate you so much.
He is the oldest candidate in the race and will be the oldest president if he were to win ever. And he looks like he's 35 compared to her. Well, she's weakened at Bernie's. Like, she's vomiting frogs.
Right.
She won't call things what they are.
It's because nothing bothers him. He literally nothing bothers Trump.
Why do you think he had his roast on Comedy Central? Yeah, get it all out now.
Yeah.
He don't care.
Yeah.
He's just genuinely having a great time. Bye-bye, Hillary. Get some sleep. I'll see you Monday night.
I gotta say, I know Matt's got to get going, so we got to wrap this up. And we'll talk even more about domestic terrorism and how Rob Kendall perpetuates it next time.
That's right.
You know, he is the one that brought the jihadists to Brownsburg. I don't know if you remember that little incident. But
it is true.
Lion Rob let him immigrate and didn't build the wall. Huh? That's why he's so pro-wall now. He didn't build it when he could. But, yeah, you know, I mean, it is going to be – Monday's going to be the most fun presidential debate in the history of the country. There will be no policy.
Yep.
It will be blatant yard school name calling, and everyone that's ever gone against Donald Trump and tried to go at him has lost to a moniker. Low Energy Jeb.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Lion Ted. And when little Marco had him on the ropes and he threw that out, he only got 2% in his home state with $35 million in spending. So if he labels her with a moniker Monday night, the election's over, because no one can withstand a Trump moniker. And
crooked Hillary.
I don't know if that's it. I feel like there's.
You think he's got a new one? He's got up a new one.
And I think it comes to him in real time. Like, Jeb Bush is low energy.
Right.
Ted Cruz is a liar, and Marco's little. He wears high heels.
Like, it is such a. He's just a genius. Like, if you look at him going on Dr. Oz, the reason he's going on Dr. Oz is who watches Dr. Oz?
Women at home.
Women of lower class, like lower class women. Lower class white women. And, you know, oh, is he going to do it? Should I do it? Should I pull it out? Yay! All right, here's my...
And it's basically cliff notes of like a readout from a printer.
It's nothing, but that's... We don't care. He's given us the truth. Right.
Yeah. It was so fun, though. I feel like a kid at Christmas because this is the political debate I've been waiting for my whole life. Nothing of substance, just... a Clinton getting lambasted by the most awful demon imaginable that has no shame. Because so, she could call him the biggest orange face buffoon on earth. Oh, Rand Paul already did it. Right. He can look at her and be like, how's Bill treat women, Hillary?
I'll be disappointed if that Trump doesn't show up.
I know. He was very good today.
He's been very well behaved lately, and I'm very disappointed. Yeah. Okay, so on Monday night, so very special announcement. I'll actually probably put this at the front, too. We are going to live stream from 7:15 up until about 8:45, 9 o'clock. A special We Are Libertarians live from Morty's Comedy Joint. We're doing a live show.
An election special.
An election special. So we're going to preview the debate. Greg and I are going to have a cast of stars come out. And Blair Englehart has already agreed to show up. He asked if he could be on the panel. And I said, why not?
Oh, my God. Thanks for betting that with me.
Will he be Tom Servo?
No, he'll just be there briefly. And then at 9 o'clock, we're not going to live stream this. You got to be there to be there. We're going to Mystery Science Theater 3000, the debate. Greg and I will have a microphone, and we'll give live running commentary through the debate as we watch it on a big screen. You can drink with your libertarian buddies. You can have all kinds of fun. It's going to be a great night. It's going to be so much fun.
You can watch America get made great again.
Yep. And then... and then we'll have a little recap, maybe that night, but definitely the next day we're going to get together with Rob Kendall and roast him. So Monday night, be sure to look at that on your Facebook. But even better, come out to Morty's Comedy Joint if you're in Indianapolis. Hell, people are making the drive from Fort Wayne, Chicago. Chris Lane, our good buddy, he was in from Oregon, and he's in Chicago that night. He was going to try and drive down, but it didn't
work out.
That's
amazing.
That's awesome. So Chris, my dude. All right. At the end of the show, Matt, what we do is we like to go around and any point that you didn't get in because I talk too much or anything that you'd like to self-promote, if you have anything going on.
I might self-promote a little bit. So speaking of debates, I will make the first official loud announcement here. I will be participating in a debate with my two opponents on October 27th in Westfield.
Are you going to call them tiny-handed losers?
That is among my strategies.
Not your strengths, but your strategies.
So that's exciting. So running for Congress is, as you know, you've heard at the beginning of the show. So check me out on Facebook. There's Matt Whitliff for Congress.
Spell that.
W-I-T-T-L-I-E-F, as in Frank. And then also my website, www.whitlifforcongress.com. Those are the main two places. I'm also on Twitter. So come follow the campaign. If you live in the 5th District, love to have your support. If you live in America, I'd love to have your money to help promote that campaign.
I mean, if you listen
if you
to this
don't,
episode,
give it to the Clinton Global first and then request to be forwarded to Matt.
It's really pretty much A or B.
Yeah.
I mean, you clearly, he's very thoughtful. He's very, he deserves to be in Congress.
Yes, he is vastly more prepared, eloquent, and a much better choice than either of your two opponents. And I endorse Matt Whitliff sincerely and from the bottom of my heart. And if you don't vote for him, you live in the 5th District, and we find out, boy, are you...
listen.
My opponent is a big... she's big in favor of the security state. So.
Oh, she's an
crooked,
absolute...
You, crooked Susan.
Her husband, David Brooks...
Oh, boy.
David Brooks is the hatchet man for the local Republican Party. He's what they call the fixer. So he comes in, and I think we've talked about David on the show before, and Susan... So, David, anytime there's a close election and you need five extra votes to get you right over the... You bring in David, and he makes sure that you win the election. I've personally watched it happen in two races that I was involved with. One, Scott Keller won by 3 votes for city council, and John Elrod won by 14 votes for state house, so in predominantly Democratic districts. I'm sure it's all above board. So, yes, Matt, I'm nominating you for president in 4 years. Sorry, you can't argue. Greg Lenz.
All I'll say is, so I haven't been one to look at Hillary's health nearly like dear leader Chris Spangle has.
I'm way down the rabbit hole. She's seizing.
The seizures and then the eye thing. I don't know if you've seen the video. Her eyes are out of touch.
I didn't find that compelling.
The left eye, she looked like Tracy McGrady like 3 or 4 times.
She did.
She was looking in two directions. She was T-Mac.
Who's the guy who is the butler, the White House butler? Oh, but she had Forrest Whitaker eye.
Forrest Whitaker.
She had Forrest Whitaker eye a little bit.
Yeah.
But I didn't find that nearly as compelling as the seizing and some of the, like, the press.
The bouncing?
Yeah.
That one time?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I tell you what. I hope she has a seizure on stage. I hope Trump triggers her.
Terrible.
No, not a real, like, a deathly seizure, but one of those weird bobbing and popping things she does.
Well, that remember with the balloons where she was like, ooh! There's a
and
lot
that
of
wicked syphilis canker sore.
A lot of people
tongue.
Think that.
I think we're going to get a lot of laughing.
That weird reaction was a seizure. So, and it's triggered by loud noises, according to William J. Law, I think it was, on YouTube, who is a credible source.
You think Trump's just going to go boom? He's going to open the debate and go, Hillary!
So we'll see. I mean, if. This is really high risk for her. She's got three debates, and if something happens in these debates, the alt-right, you know, is going to be all over it.
Oh, it's so fantastic.
It's going to be one of the best. Oh, if you love memes, it's going to be
great.
I'm
holding out hope that will open the door for Gary to get into round two.
I know, me too. So, I think Gary'd probably have to laugh, though, if Trump opened it and screamed at her.
So if you... If you love memes, go to WeAreLibertarians.com, scroll down on the and join our Facebook group, and if you see any funny memes after the debate, hell, post them in there. We love memes. Greg, other thoughts other than Hillary
I'm ready to go so Matt can get out of here.
All right, fine.
Well, I know he's like
literally... I've got to go pick up my wife.
Yeah,
family duty.
Uh-oh. Yeah, his wife's hot and foreign, so he's
I love immigrants.
I just want to ask you to support We Are Libertarians. We're really trying to give it our all here in this last final 50 days. I'm probably spending 20 hours a week at least lately on We Are Libertarians and still not getting anywhere near what I need to get done, just so we can continue to give you as much information. So please, just as a thank you, share it. That's the least you can do. That is absolutely the very least you can do. And if you want to be a superstar, then please join us and send us some money so we can pay for things like the SoundCloud and the hosting and the you know, soon to be the email newsletter. So that kind of stuff. So we can do more. So we'd love your financial support. Listen, this makes us no money. And you can get a free Audible book if you go to audibletrial.com/WAL. I'm just listening to Tyranny of the Cliches by Jonah Goldberg. If you've never listened to that or read that book, you have to. It's a masterpiece. I'm not joking. It's a masterpiece. So we will see you Monday night. We will have an episode for you, and we thank you so much for being here with us. We love our audience. You're the greatest audience. You're so much better than Roger Paxton's audience.
Than Lion Rob Kendall's audience.
The Lava Flow podcast is a tiny podcast. Rob Kendall has such low ratings. Johnny Rocket Launchpad, I don't know what happened to them. They used to be so great. Now they're nothing.
They got crooked.
Lions of Liberty just celebrated 3 years. Three terrible years. They're nothing compared to us. Go check out our friends. All right. Thank you for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. We will see you next week. And as always, we promise
to do better next time.
Hey, guys. It's me. That's right. I'm back. It's Chris Spangle. You know, you just heard me talking in the middle of this show, and then I said, let's take a break and hear more of me. I'm sure that's what I said, because that's what I would say if I were doing the podcast and listening to this again. But I'm here to tell you what we do with your money when you donate it to us by giving us $5 a month through PayPal, Patreon. You can go to Patreon, and if we don't do a show, we don't get paid, so it gives us incentive to get paid. What's more libertarian than that? What we do with that money is we apply it to advertising and equipment. We do things to grow the podcast so more people can hear our voice. I want you to think about it. You like We Are Libertarians. I know it's your favorite podcast. You know it's your favorite podcast. Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.